The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That's gsuggsinsurance.com. Or call 919-875-8889. Today's issue of Time Magazine is dated October 25/November 1, 2021. Bordered in red, as usual, with an inner border of white, the background of today's front cover of Time has a white time written in large block lettering, superimposed upon a part of a face. I don't identify this face at all, and I see no caption identifying it. It's a youngish face with freckles and probably blue or blue-gray eyes. It is in color, but it's a rather blurry, colorized version. It's a male wearing a dark suit with a white shirt and a polka-dotted tie. We see only a shoulder and head shot here. There's no nose or mouth facing the camera because it's been whited out by a superimposed label, it appears, and upon that is written "Delete Facebook?" Cancel on one side in blue, delete on the other in red, with a black arrow pointing to the individual's chin. One can speculate on the identity, but I won't, because it's not indicated. Moving then to the text within, I'll begin with the brief opener. Politics, McConnell's debt gamble. On the facing page, there is a photograph of a GOP leader, Senate GOP leader, Mitch McConnell. It's in black and white, and it's in mostly black and gray. One sees the forehead and hairline in gray-white of the gentleman pictured. His eyes look askance from the camera. He's wearing round spectacles. His nose is partially visible. It's gray at this point. His mouth is not visible because it's in a darker gray to charcoal to black fade. It's apparent that he's wearing a dark suit. One sees only the top of the collar and a striped shirt beneath it. This is by Philip Elliott, McConnell's debt gamble. As Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell mulled, blocking Democrats from raising the nation's debt ceiling, he faced two scenarios. Neither was good. In the first, the U.S. could default on its debt, triggering a global recession and costing Americans millions of jobs. In the second, Democrats could get rid of the filibuster to raise the ceiling without GOP help and create a Senate where the party in power, notably not McConnell's, could prevail with a simple majority vote. So McConnell relented, agreeing October 6 Republicans would allow a temporary extension of the debt ceiling to the end of the year. A vote to that effect passed in the Senate October 7 and in the House of Representatives October 12. But the deal McConnell offered should not be confused with magnanimity. With Democrats in control of the House, the Senate, and the White House, he's maneuvering to extract as high a political price as possible for helping avoid a financial crisis. The debt ceiling's a vestige of World War I, created to curb unlimited spending on a conflict many Americans would have preferred to sit out. It requires lawmakers to vote periodically to raise the amount of money the government can borrow to pay bills, and has been lifted by both parties as a routine matter for most of the last century. The ceiling's been raised 78 times since 1960. But in 2006, lawmakers started to use what had always been a procedural vote as a way to virtue signal. That year, Democrats, including then-Senator Joe Biden, used a debt ceiling vote to lodge an election year protest against President George W. Bush's tax cuts and heavy military spending. In the end, Democrats allowed the hike to clear without getting their way, but it started a nasty political habit. Over the next 15 years, debate around the debt ceiling careened into the partisan gutter. In 2011, the new GOP majority in the House led a revolt over the Obama administration's spending and threatened the nation's first ever default. Ultimately, Obama signed a deal that reduced deficits by more than $2 trillion without any new taxes. 2 years later, House Republicans linked a looming default deadline to scrapping Obamacare. In that case, McConnell stepped in to help negotiate a climb down, and Republicans retreated in defeat. More recently, the U.S. faced an October 18 deadline to move the country's current borrowing limit of $28.4 trillion higher. For months, McConnell had insisted if Democrats planned to pass Biden's multi-trillion dollar Build Back Better Act through reconciliation, a procedural loophole that would not require any GOP votes, then they could raise the debt limit the same way, in other words, alone. Democrats said they did not have enough time to make the complicated process work, and given the dire implications of a default, 6 million jobs gone, a 9% unemployment rate, and a $15 trillion slash to the stock market, according to Moody's, some Democratic senators started to seriously consider ditching the filibuster to get around McConnell. If all Democrats agreed, they could nix the archaic rule that requires three-fifths of the Senate to vote together to end debate on a matter and stop Republicans from holding up the vote. Progressives have long been agitating to get rid of the filibuster, arguing too much of the Democrats' agenda is stuck because the minority party can gum it up. Institutionalists had resisted such talk, but October 5, the nation's institutionalist-in-chief, President Biden, said dumping the filibuster solely to raise the debt limit was a real possibility. A day later, McConnell offered his deal, a $480 billion boost to the borrowing limit, which would push the default deadline back to December. Senator Elizabeth Warren said McConnell caved, an assessment many Democrats seemed eager to amplify, but others spotted a trap. The extension gave Democrats a brief reprieve to regroup and pivot back to their other big problem, getting their own members on board with Biden's agenda. Democrats continue to harangue the Senate saboteurs, Kyrsten Sinema and Joe Manchin, either of whom can scuttle the Democrats' agenda in a 50-50 chamber to get on board the Biden train. Both lawmakers said the price tag and reach of the Build Back Better bill are too high, and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says she won't bring the plan to a vote in her chamber till she's sure it can pass the Senate, leaving it and a separate Senate-passed infrastructure package of $550 billion in new spending in limbo. Biden, who campaigned as an insider skilled in legislative compromise, has been reluctant to browbeat Democrats and could end up paying politically for a failure. McConnell, a political infighter without peer in Washington, understands all this. Even if Biden is able to corral Democrats to pass his plans, it will play to McConnell's advantage when the debt ceiling issue crops back up in December. At that point, McConnell is still likely to force Democrats, fresh off a spending plan of historic proportion, to pass a borrowing increase along party lines. The increase won't have anything to do with the vast sum Democrats committed to spend, but it won't look that way to many voters, and it's probably safe to say McConnell won't be shy about laying blame for all that red ink with the Democrats. Bulletin: Philippine elections will test Rodrigo Duterte's legacy. That's Duterte. Nobody has dominated the Philippine political landscape in recent years like President Rodrigo Duterte. But as jockeying begins in earnest for the country's 2022 presidential and vice presidential elections, there are signs that the one-time strongman has become a liability. Limited to a single presidential term under the Philippine Constitution, Duterte had intended to stand for vice president, but was seemingly wrong-footed by a sharp backlash, with critics accusing the instigator of the nation's bloody drug war of angling to hold on to power. Stepping back, October 2, Duterte appeared to bow to the inevitable, withdrawing his vice presidential plans and announcing his retirement. But he's announced retirement plans before, in 2015 only to win a landslide victory in presidential elections a year later. And Duterte certainly has every motivation to stay in high office. It would grant him ongoing immunity from prosecutions related to the drug war, currently the subject of a probe by the International Criminal Court, or his botched handling of the COVID-19 pandemic. All eyes are therefore on his next move. In the current geopolitical climate, the elections will have global impact. Home to more than 110 million people, the Philippines occupies a strategic location on the southeastern rim of the South China Sea and has been assiduously courted by both Washington and Beijing. Its many seaports, economic potential, it just reported its fastest growth in 30 years, even amid the pandemic, and young population make the country a choice regional ally. As Duterte sets himself up to be either king or kingmaker, some observers believe he's losing his touch. Influential friends appear to be turning their backs on him, with a notable defection by boxer-turned-senator Manny Pacquiao, who September 19 announced his own presidential ambitions. The election arena may be tougher than Duterte anticipated, says Richard Hydarian, an associate professor of political science at Polytechnic University of the Philippines. But Hydarian also believes Duterte capable of an 11th-hour plot twist. He makes his decision constantly based on the shifting balance of forces on the ground. That article by Chad de Guzman. There's a photo on the top of this page. It's all in red, a little bit of white and blue up at the upper horizon. Two people in space suits walking across this red desert-like terrain. It's called Red Stand-In. The caption's written by Madeline Carlisle. Astronauts stroll in the Ramon Crater in Israel's Negev Desert, October 10, during a Mars training mission. The month-long simulation run by the Austrian Space Forum, in partnership with the Israel Space Agency, is meant to help prepare for future exploration of the Red Planet. The six members of the team from Portugal, Spain, Germany, Netherlands, Austria, and Israel are only allowed to leave their base in the crater wearing space suits. Three short items from the news ticker. Trove of tax shelter docs, DOCS, unveiled. The largest ever leak of offshore data, the release of the Pandora Papers, October 3, exposed hundreds of world leaders, public officials, and business people using secretive financial dealings to avoid taxation, sparking scandals in dozens of countries. Navy engineer charged on sub-secrets. After FBI sting that involved the couple hiding memory cards in sandwiches and chewing gum. October 9, a U.S. Navy engineer and his wife were arrested for selling classified information about the design of nuclear-powered warships to a person they believed was a representative of a foreign power. UN punts on climate change lawsuit. A UN committee announced October 11 it will not rule on a lawsuit filed by a group of young climate activists, including Greta Thunberg, against five countries for violating their rights by failing to adequately fight climate change. The committee said the suit must first be filed in national courts. For the record, here are some shorter items on one page. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. It was a nice break from everything, said Lavaya Nanjakana. That's Nanjikana. Discussing 29 days he and a fellow seaman spent lost at sea in an October 8 interview with The Guardian. The two men were rescued off the coast of Papua New Guinea October 2. Trust and integrity are the cornerstones of the multinational organizations I have faithfully served for more than four decades. That statement by Kristalina Georgieva, Georgieva, managing director of the International Monetary Fund, in an October 11 statement after she retained her position amid allegations she had been directly involved with efforts to improve China's ranking in a 2018 economic report while working at the World Bank. The IMF's board cited no conclusive evidence of Georgieva's wrongdoing. $70 million, amount Trump International Hotel in Washington, D.C., lost during former President Trump's presidency, per congressional documents released October 8. Divorce Babe Divorce, Adele, A-D-E-L-E, explaining what inspired songs on her forthcoming album, 30, that's 30, the numerals, in an October 9 Instagram Live. Everyone needs heroes, and everyone deserves to see themselves in their heroes, Tom Taylor said. DC Comics author announcing in an October 11 interview that the series New Superman will come out as bisexual in a forthcoming issue. Hello, literally everyone. Twitter, in an October 4 tweet posted during a six-hour period in which Facebook, Instagram, and WhatsApp were down worldwide. You can get out there and enjoy it, Dr. Anthony Fauci says, endorsing trick-or-treating, particularly if you're vaccinated, in an October 10 interview with CNN. 111 million, the number of accounts that tuned in to the South Korean series Squid Game, Netflix announced October 12, making it its biggest series launch ever. Good news of the week, more than 4 years after she was kidnapped by extremists in Mali, Colombian nun Gloria Cecilia Narvaez, that's N-A-R-V-A-E-Z, was freed October 9. More brief news, three more news tickers. Record numbers leave U.S. workforce. The Bureau of Labor Statistics reported October 12, 4.3 million Americans quit their jobs in August 2021, the highest monthly total ever recorded. The report also marked the sixth consecutive month of unusually high resignation rates across the U.S. Appeals court restores Texas abortion law, overruling the Biden administration's attempt to block the legislation just 2 days earlier. A federal appeals court panel October 8, granted Texas a stay to continue enforcing its ban on abortions from about the sixth week of pregnancy, while lawsuits and appeals over the law move through the courts. Reunification threat roils Taiwan. Tensions between China and Taiwan reached perhaps their worst point in decades in the run-up to the latter's National Day, October 10. Chinese President Xi Jinping promised reunification with Taiwan, which he considers a renegade Chinese province, and sent 150 warplanes into its airspace. This is called a postcard inside the U.S. base where Afghans wait. By Vera Bergengruen, Fort McCoy, the place. There's a photo here. It's of a grassy field with trees in the background, and there's a building, a white building with a red roof, and beyond the trees and the building is a blue sky with a few white clouds and a couple of power poles with lines strung in between, and the backs of two young women, probably, or older girls, is shown. One is wearing dark clothing, perhaps black or very dark blue, and one sees the dress, her shoes, I think she's wearing some kind of sandals, and a long black scarf. No faces are shown here, and the other girl or young woman is wearing a brown and yellow floral print skirt, silvery colored shoes, and she's wearing a yellow gold scarf on the back of her head. On the last morning of September, the caption reads, Afghan refugees watch a soccer game at Fort McCoy, September 30. On the last morning of September, dozens of Afghan children cheered on their older brothers as they played a lively game of soccer with U.S. soldiers on a military base in rural Wisconsin. The kids ran up the pitch dressed in a mix of traditional tunics and flashy donated jackets and sneakers stamped with American logos. Fort McCoy, a sprawling army base surrounded by cornfields, is hosting the largest population of new Afghan evacuees in the U.S. Since late August, it's taken in more than 12,600 refugees, almost half of them children. Families were sorted into orderly white barracks where they await their immigration paperwork, employment authorizations, and vaccinations. Kids make arts and crafts and play frisbee with volunteers while parents take English classes. Outside this welcoming bubble, the Biden administration's efforts to settle 95,000 Afghan evacuees by September 2022 has become a partisan flashpoint. Republicans in Washington have tried to cut off housing, medical help, food, and other aid to Afghan refugees as of 2023. Near Fort McCoy, local GOP leaders have channeled former President Donald Trump by raising alarms about security risks, even though U.S. officials have described the evacuees' extensive vetting. The result's a disorienting split screen. More than 7 in 10 Americans support resettling Afghans who worked with the U.S. government or military, according to a recent NPR Ipsos poll. Yet as rumors fly and Republicans seize on the issue, some locals are unnerved. As far as I'm concerned, they don't belong here, area resident Lee O'Neill says of the Afghans. I haven't met one person around here that's happy about it. It is not clear how long the evacuees will be at Fort McCoy. The group's largely made up of people who worked with the U.S. in Afghanistan, like translators, drivers, cooks, and pilots, as well as others whose jobs put them at risk, like human rights advocates and aid workers. Military officials on base are preparing for falling temperatures by fitting the evacuees for coats and boots and erecting a tent to shield people waiting in meal lines. Meanwhile, some evacuees are following the political debate over their presence. I don't care what anybody says. I'm just thankful for what's happening, says Kawaga Ghani, a 30-year-old journalist from Kabul. The people who were scared for their lives They're safe now. Milestones resigned. John, J-O-N, Gruden, G-R-U-D-E-N. Benched by Bigotry, by Sean Gregory. One message included a racist trope about NFL Players Association executive director Demoris Smith, another an anti-gay slur directed at NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell. Recent reports from the Wall Street Journal and New York Times have documented Las Vegas Raiders coach John Gruden's use of racist, homophobic, and misogynistic language in emails denouncing female referees, an openly gay player, and athletes calling attention to social inequalities during the national anthem. Gruden resigned October 11. Over the past decade, the NFL's confronted crises, including revelations about players' head trauma, the mishandling of the Ray Rice domestic violence investigation, and rows over Colin Kaepernick's activism, but still continue to expand its reach and revenue. In 2010, the NFL generated some $8.5 billion. By 2019, the figure had nearly doubled to $16 billion, before a pandemic-related drop to $12 billion in 2020. Gruden's emails, however, could pose some risk. The incident has, after all, crudely reminded America about the league's race problems. Around 60% of NFL players are black, but there are only three black coaches. And according to the NFL's 2020 Racial and Gender Report Card from the Institute of Diversity and Ethics in Sport at the University of Central Florida, teams received a failing grade for their hiring of women in senior leadership roles. This could be a tipping point, says Kenneth Shropshire, CEO of the Global Sports Institute at Arizona State University, suggesting owners and executives consider decisions that illustrate they are thinking about this new society that we're in. One, that is, where John Gruden no longer has a place in the NFL. Agreed. Tax minimums, global consensus on a taxing issue, by Alana Samuels. For decades, many of the world's richest companies have figured out creative ways to pay lower taxes. They declared on paper some of their money-making assets were located in low-tax places like Bermuda, Hungary, or Ireland, which in turn motivated countries to lower their corporate tax rates to attract the intangible assets of an Apple or Amazon. But in an October 8 deal negotiated by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, 136 countries and jurisdictions, including economic giants like China, Russia, and India, as well as longtime corporate tax havens, have agreed to try and limit these practices. The deal, which would go into effect in 2023 if ratified by individual countries, sets a global minimum tax rate of 15%, aimed at ending what U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen calls the race to the bottom on global taxation. It also requires tech companies to pay taxes in countries where people buy their goods and services, reallocating $125 billion to markets where those companies operate. If passed by Congress, the deal could set the stage for more corporate tax changes from President Joe Biden's administration, which had initially suggested a 21% global minimum tax, since companies won't have as many places to relocate if they're upset with higher U.S. tax rates. Detractors say the agreement does not go far enough, but the rate's higher than the 10.5% minimum rate U.S. companies currently pay on foreign profits. The Biden administration says it will use the money to pay for infrastructure, child care, and clean energy. And finally, the column under milestones with several entries. Died Abdul Qadir Khan, K-H-A-N, father of Pakistan's nuclear bomb, who also aided North Korea, Libya, and Iran. October 10 at 85. Ruthie Thompson, T-O-M-P-S-O-N, animator, who for decades worked on classic Disney films. October 10 at 111. Selected. Five women leaders, including poet Maya Angelou and astronaut Sally Ride, to appear on U.S. quarters beginning in 2020. The U.S. Mint confirmed October 6. Authorized U.S. sales of Views Solo. That's V-U-S-E space, S-O-L-O. October 12. The first electronic cigarette approved by the Food and Drug Administration. Opened a trial for 14 men, including its former president, Blaise Compaoré, over the 1987 assassination of Burkina Faso's revolutionary leader, Thomas Sankara, October 11. Refused rights to an Israeli publisher for a Hebrew translation of her latest novel, Irish author Sally Rooney confirmed October 12, citing her support of the BDS movement. Resigned Austrian Chancellor Sebastian Kurz October 9 amid corruption allegations, which Kurz denies. Launched a Blue Origin rocket October 13, carrying the actor William Shatner among its passengers. At 90, Shatner's now the oldest person who's traveled in space. Health lessons for the next pandemic. October 6, the World Health Organization announced it was recommending a malaria vaccine, the first ever such shot for mosquito-borne infectious disease that kills hundreds of thousands of people every year. It is a huge development in the effort to put an end to the oldest pandemic still stalking the planet. But its limitations are real and offer a view into what we need to do to prepare for the next global disease. Medical breakthroughs on their own cannot defeat malaria. Vaccines, tests, and treatments don't deliver themselves. Health workers do. Indeed, Thailand cut its malaria cases by 90% by training 1 million community health workers over the past decade. And El Salvador used community health workers to rid the country of malaria altogether. Every pandemic's different, but we use the same muscles to fight it. Community health workers in Nigeria who've gone door to door to test for malaria are now being equipped with COVID-19 tests. And a recent scientific review of 28 nations' COVID-19 response found those that made greater investments in community health workers had lower death rates. Building up the systems to fight today's pandemics may be the most effective way to prepare for the pandemics of tomorrow. That was written by Dr. Raj Punjabi, U.S. Global Malaria Coordinator. The Risk Report by Ian Bremmer, Europe's most fragile young democracies are in trouble. Europe's youngest democracies are facing serious political turmoil. An unresolved election in the Czech Republic, a controversial court ruling in Poland, political stalemate in Bulgaria, and a Hungarian government gearing up for a fight are all creating complex challenges for EU officials. In the Czech Republic, the October 8, October 9 election produced only confusion and the risk of a constitutional crisis. The party of populist Prime Minister Andrej Babis, B-A-B-I-S, a billionaire who rose to power by railing against elites, suffered a surprise defeat at the hands of center-right Together coalition. But Czech law allows the president to decide who can try to form a government. And President Milos Zeman, a Babis ally who was taken seriously ill October 10, had previously said the party receiving the most votes should have that right. Babis' party narrowly did that, but does not appear to have the allies in parliament to form a majority government. No one knows what will happen next. In Poland, the country's highest court ruled October 7 that within Poland, national law takes precedence over EU law, a direct rejection of one of the bloc's, BLOC's, foundational principles. Poland's populist government was quick to embrace the ruling, which it had itself requested, but the public has divided sharply over the issue. Tens of thousands took to the streets across the nation October 9 to support the EU. This challenge is too direct for the European Commission to ignore, but its options are limited. It can try to strip Poland of its EU voting rights, but Hungary, an ally that's faced similar threats in recent years, would veto the move. The EU can move to withhold budget payments from the country till its government backs down, but that option would punish all of Poland's people, including those who rallied in support of Europe. There's also political turmoil in Bulgaria, which joined the EU in 2007, 3 years after the Czech Republic, Poland, and Hungary. Public anger over rampant corruption forced former Prime Minister Boyko Borisov from power earlier this year, but parliamentary elections in April and July failed to produce a government. President Ruman Radev has called a third vote for November. On the horizon is more trouble with Hungary's Viktor Orbán, a man who's already defied the EU to wage war on independent judges and reporters, opposition parties, and refugees seeking asylum. Now, Hungary's strongman is preparing for national elections next spring, in which he faces an anti-Orbán alliance that spans the political spectrum, from the Socialist Party to pro-business liberals to the formerly far-right Jobbik. The opposition wants to define Hungary's choice as Orbán or Europe. Current polls predict a close race. These political deadlocks come at a time of shifting leadership at the heart of Europe. Germany's Angela Merkel, who's helped preserve the delicate balance between pressure and engagement in relations with Europe's smallest, youngest, and most fragile democracies, is preparing to retire. Her replacement, probably Socialist Party leader Olaf Scholz, will try the same approach but with less stature on the European stage. France's president, Emmanuel Macron, will face his own battle for re-election next year, and some of his rivals will work to profit from French sympathy for those across the EU who want Brussels to have less power. Not a good moment for a leadership shortage in Europe. Under business breaking point, Facebook's civic integrity team prided itself on putting people before profits. Then it was shut down by Billy Perrigo, P-E-R-R-I-G-O. A photograph here, well, a partial photograph of a partial face, a young woman with blue eyes, pale skin, or maybe it's made up to look pale, and light blonde hair. It's Facebook whistleblower Frances Haugen, H-A-U-G-E-N, during her Senate testimony October 5. And that photograph is by Drew Ongerer. This lengthy article will probably be abridged. Facebook's civic integrity team was always different from the other teams the social media company employed to combat misinformation and hate speech. For starters, its leader expected team members to subscribe to an informal oath vowing to serve the people's interest first, not Facebook's. The civic oath, according to five former employees, charged team members with understanding Facebook's impact on the world, keeping people safe, and defusing angry polarization. Samid Chakrabarty, the team's leader, regularly referred to this oath, which has not been previously reported, as a set of guiding principles behind the team's work, they said. Chakrabarty's team was effective in fixing some of the problems endemic to the platform, former employees and Facebook itself have said. But just a month after the 2020 U.S. election, Facebook dissolved the civic integrity team. and Chakrabarty took a leave of absence. Facebook said employees were assigned to other teams to help share the group's experience across the company, but for many of the Facebook employees who'd worked on the team, including a veteran product manager from Iowa named Francis Haugen, the message was clear. Facebook no longer wanted to concentrate power in a team whose priority was to put people ahead of profits. 5 weeks later, supporters of Donald Trump stormed the U.S. Capitol after some of them had organized on Facebook and used the platform to spread the lie that the election had been stolen. The Civic Integrity team's dissolution made it harder for the platform to respond effectively to January 6, a former team member who left Facebook this year told Time. The former employee, along with several others Time interviewed, spoke on the condition of anonymity for fear that being named would ruin their career. Haugen revealed her identity October 3 as the whistleblower behind the most significant leak of internal research in Facebook's 17-year history. In bombshell testimony to the Senate Subcommittee on Consumer Protection, Product Safety, and Data Security 2 days later, Haugen said the Civic Integrity team's breakup was the final event in a long series that convinced her of the need to blow the whistle. "I think the moment which I realized we needed to get help from the outside, that the only way these problems would be solved is by solving them together, not solving them alone, was when Civic Integrity was dissolved following the 2020 election," she said. "It really felt like a betrayal of the promises Facebook had made to people who had sacrificed a great deal to keep the election safe by basically dissolving our community." In a statement provided to Time, Facebook's Guy Rosen, whose title is Vice President for Integrity, denied the Civic Integrity team had been disbanded. "We integrated it into a larger central integrity team so that the incredible work pioneered for elections could be applied even further." Facebook did not make Rosen available for an interview for this story. Asked if Facebook executives adhered to the same set of values as the Civic Integrity team, including putting the public's interests before the company's, a spokesperson told Time it was safe to say everyone at Facebook is committed to understanding our impact, keeping people safe and reducing polarization. Haugen left Facebook in May. Before she departed, she trawled its internal employee forum for documents posted by integrity researchers about their work. Much of the research was not related to her job, but was accessible to all Facebook employees. What she found surprised her. Some of the documents detailed an internal study that found Facebook's photo-sharing app Instagram made 32% of teen girls feel worse about their bodies. Others showed how a change to Facebook's news feed ranking algorithm in 2018, touted as a way to increase meaningful social interactions on the platform, actually incentivized divisive posts and misinformation. The documents also revealed Facebook spends almost all its budget for platform safety only on English language content. In September, the Wall Street Journal published a damning series of articles based on some of these documents, which Haugen also shared with Congress and the Securities and Exchange Commission, SEC. Now I'm skipping ahead a few paragraphs. Chakrabarty, head of the Civic Integrity team, was hired by Facebook in 2015 from Google, where he'd worked on improving how the search engine communicated information about lawmakers and elections to its users. A polymath described by one person who worked under him as a Renaissance man, Chakrabarty holds master's degrees from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, Oxford, and Cambridge in artificial intelligence engineering, modern history, and public policy, respectively, according to his LinkedIn profile. He did not respond to requests to comment for this article. Although he was not in charge of Facebook's company-wide integrity efforts, which are led by Rosen, Chakrabarty was widely seen by employees as the spiritual leader of the push to make sure the platform had a positive influence on democracy and user safety, according to multiple former employees. He was a very inspirational figure to us, and he really embodied those values enshrined in the civic oath and took them quite seriously, a former member of the team tells Time. The team prioritized societal good over Facebook good. It was a team that really cared about the ways to address societal problems first and foremost. It was not a team that was dedicated to contributing to Facebook's bottom line. Chakrabarty began work on the team by questioning how Facebook could encourage people to be more engaged with their elected representatives on the platform, several of his former team members said. An early move was to suggest tweaks to Facebook's More Pages You May Like feature that the team hoped might make users feel more like they could have an impact on politics. After the chaos of the 2016 election, which prompted CEO Mark Zuckerberg himself to admit Facebook did not do enough to stop misinformation, the team evolved. It moved into Facebook's wider integrity product group, which employs thousands of researchers and engineers to focus on fixing Facebook's problems of misinformation, hate speech, foreign interference and harassment, and began tackling the platform's most difficult problems head on. Shortly before the midterm elections in 2018, Chakrabarty gave a talk at a conference in which he said he had never been told to sacrifice people's safety in order to chase a profit. His team was hard at work making sure the midterm elections did not suffer the failures of 2016 in an effort that was generally seen as a success both inside the company and externally. To see the way that the company has mobilized to make this happen has made me feel very good about what we're doing here, Chakrabarty told reporters at the time. But behind closed doors, integrity employees on Chakrabarty's team and others were increasingly getting into disagreements with Facebook leadership, former employees said. It was the beginning of the process that would eventually motivate Haugen to blow the whistle. In 2019, the year Haugen joined the company, researchers on the civic integrity team proposed ending the policy that exempted politicians from Facebook's fact-checking program, according to tech news sites, The Information. The researchers had found that the exemptions worsened the site's misinformation problem because users were more likely to believe false information if it were shared by a politician. But Facebook executives rejected the proposal. The pattern repeated time and time again. Proposals to tweak the platform to de-emphasize misinformation or abuse were rejected or watered down by executives concerned with engagement or worried that changes might disproportionately impact one political party more than another, according to multiple reports in the press and several former employees. One cynical joke among members of the civic integrity team was that they spent 10% of their time coding and the other 90% arguing that the code they wrote should be allowed to run, one former employee told Time. You write code that does exactly what it's supposed to do, then you had to argue with execs who did not want to think about integrity, had no training in it, and were mad you were hurting their product, so they shut you down, the person said. Sometimes the civic integrity team would also come into conflict with Facebook's policy teams, which share the dual role of setting the rules of the platform while also lobbying politicians on Facebook's behalf. I found many times there were tensions in meetings because the civic integrity team was like, we're operating off this oath. This is our mission and goal, says Katie Harbath, a long-serving public policy director at the company's Washington office who quit in March. And then you get into decision-making meetings and all of a sudden things are going another way because the rest of the company and leadership are not basing their decisions off those principles. Years before the 2020 election, research by Integrity Teams had shown Facebook's group recommendations feature was radicalizing users by driving them toward polarizing political groups, according to the journal. The company declined Integrity Teams' request to turn off the feature, BuzzFeed News reported. Then just weeks before the vote, Facebook executives changed their minds and agreed to freeze political group recommendations. The company also tweaked its news feed to make it less likely users would see content that algorithms had flagged as potential misinformation. It was one of several emergency break glass measures designed by the integrity teams in the run-up to the vote. Facebook changed those safety defaults in the run-up to the election because they knew they were dangerous, Haugen testified to senators. But they did not keep those safety measures in place long, she added, because they wanted that growth back. They wanted the acceleration on the platform back after the election. They returned to their original defaults. And the fact that they had to break the glass January 6 and turn them back on, I think that's deeply problematic. There's a small photo here of a group of four people in a room. They're surrounded by monitors of all sizes. Some are quite large. I'm going to say something like 4 feet by 6 feet. Other are smaller monitors as one would use on a personal computer. There are three men and a woman, and the caption reads, Chakra Bharti, former head of the Civic Integrity Team, and Harbath, former director of public policy. Returning to the text, after Haugen's Senate testimony, Facebook's director of policy communications, Lena Peach, that's P-I-E-T-S-C-H, suggested Haugen's criticisms were invalid because she worked at the company for less than 2 years, had no direct reports, never attended a decision point meeting with C-level executives, and testified more than 6 times to not working on the subject matter in question. On Twitter, Chakra Bharti said he did not agree with the practice of leaking, but spoke out in support of the points Haugen raised at the hearing. I was there for over 6 years, had numerous direct reports, and led many decision meetings with C-level execs, and I find the perspectives shared on the need for algorithmic regulation, research and transparency, and independent oversight to be entirely valid for debate, he wrote. The public deserves better. Again, I'm skipping ahead to the end of this article. When Zuckerberg was hauled to testify in front of lawmakers after the Cambridge Analytical data scandal in 2018, senators were roundly mocked on social media for asking uninformed questions. In 2021, that dynamic has changed. The questions asked are a lot more informed, says Sophie Zhang, an earlier whistleblower, whom Facebook fired in 2020 after she criticized the company for ignoring platform manipulation by political actors around the world. The sentiment's increasingly bipartisan in Congress, Zhang adds. Both the Democratic Senator Richard Blumenthal, chair of the Subcommittee on Consumer Protection, and his Republican counterpart, Marsha Blackburn, have called for more regulatory oversight of Facebook. As Facebook reels from the recent revelations, it appears to be reassessing product decisions. It's begun conducting reputational reviews of new products and taken steps to restrict the sharing of internal research, the journal reported. It also paused its Instagram Kids product amid the furor. In a post addressing Facebook staff, October 6, Zuckerberg put the onus on lawmakers to update internet regulations, particularly relating to elections, harmful content, privacy, and competition. But the real drivers of change may be current and former employees who have a better understanding of the inner workings of the company than anyone else, and the most potential to damage the business by pointing out the harm it prefers to ignore. Again, this article was abridged. It was written by Billy Perigo with reporting by Eloise Berry, London, and Chad de Guzman, Hong Kong. Here are a couple of cookbook titles to share as we close the hour. Black Food, more than 100, that's the name of it. More than 100 black cultural figures celebrate food and community in this book, curated by chef and editor Bryant Terry. Filipinx, F-I-L-I-P-I-N-X, again the title, Chef Angela de Mayaga explores her love of Filipino food and shares stories about her family's home cooking. Zoe's Ghana Kitchen, the title. Zoe Ajonio's U.S. debut invites more home cooks to experience the flavors of West Africa. And finally, The Korean Vegan Cookbook. That's the title. TikTok Cooking Star, Joanne Lee Molinaro, a lawyer by day, offers her spin on traditional Korean cooking. And that brief column was by Annabelle Gutterman. Here's the double page photo entitled Light Box. Crude scenes. The beachgoers mingle with workers in protective suits cleaning the shoreline in Huntington Beach, California, October 11, after the shoreline was contaminated by a rupture in an underwater pipeline from an offshore oil platform. The light beige to darker tan shoreline meets the blue Pacific Ocean here. The darker shades of the tan are where the ocean has already lapped onto shore. And this is an aerial photo, so there's a colorful umbrella and lots of people dotting the shore. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine's available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.